So after Adrienne's talk yesterday about her comment that investigation of dharmas, second factor of awakening, is the most important one, I thought, imagined a debate between the factors of awakening where they would all argue that, oh, no, I'm the most important. And I could imagine the factor of energy then saying, no, it's me. Without me, everything, all the others are just idle wishing. And so, you know, energy is really important. Effort, without some kind of effort, nothing follows. Nothing is done. And it's one of the wonderful explorations, one of the wonderful investigations, how to use our ability for effort, what kind of energy and application to make, what to apply ourselves to. To discover our capacity for perseverance, our capacity for engagement and involvement in activities. It's a beautiful thing, and as we know, without effort, it's hard to get in trouble also. And so it's also some of the great difficulties that we have in life sometimes. We come from having, you know, made effort in the wrong way. And as Adrienne said so well, part of the path of practice is this discovering that we're off course. And discovering that that effort's not called for anymore. And it's not really such a strange concept. I think we all, I think we all kind of probably have something in our life where we are almost by second nature tracking ourselves well enough to know the kind of adjustments we need to make in terms of effort. So if you ride a bike, for example, there's a constant adjustment in riding the bike, how much energy to apply on the pedals. If you are going up a hill, if you see a hill coming up ahead, it's been flat for a while, but you see some people then pick up their speed a little bit to kind of get a little momentum going up the hill. And then going up the hill requires much more effort, and you don't want to coast up the hill. And then when you get to the top, you can apply less. And then when you go down the other side, you just let gravity pull you down, and you don't want to pedal as hard as you can going downhill. That might not be dangerous. Might not be safe. And so there's this, you know, and then depending on the kind of terrain that the bike is on, gravel, road, you know. So if it's gravel, I remember when I was 14, I went down a hill and made a left, and it was all gravel, and I didn't make the left, and then my bike kind of slipped out from under me. So I should have gone slower around that curve. I should have taken into account the terrain. And so how much effort we make, how much we apply ourselves to certain activities, if we're skilled at that activity, we know how to make the adjustment, and we don't even think we're doing it because it's kind of second nature to do it. So same thing with meditation and practice, is that it does require some kind of energy and effort, but as we get more and more skilled at it, the adjustments we need to make, the course corrections, are not so big anymore, just small adjustments. Or kind of second nature adjustments. But when we're first learning how to do this, the adjustments sometimes are quite big, and sometimes... And one of the advantages of going on retreat is seeing, is really beginning to see clearly the kind of effort we're making in meditation, for example. So this became very clear to me in my early first retreats I sat. I had a regular sitting practice at home, and the sitting practice at home was comfortable and nice, and I would sit there and get a little bit calm, relax, and I would pat myself on the back. Well, Gil, you're a great meditator. And then I couldn't wait to go and retreat, and I just did more of this great meditation I could do. And I would go to the retreat, and sure enough, for me, the pattern was that the first day, I did great. So settling in, this is going really well. And the second day is when I started having difficulty. And it wasn't working anymore. And I just wasn't making any more progress. And so, a logical thing to do if it's not working is you work at it harder. And so I would make more effort. And the more effort I made, the more my mind became busy and thoughtful. And the more effort I made, the less I could be settled. And so I just made more effort. And I didn't know anything else but I've got to make effort. That's what it takes. And it was usually by the third day, I would reach rock bottom. It was hopeless. And only then would I give up. I wouldn't give up because of the strategy. It was like I just bottomed out, and just felt so awful, and I was angry with myself, and restless and tense, and so I would just give up. And then, lo and behold, when I gave up, the retreat began. But what I learned in the process is that at home, when I meditated, I certainly would relax and get calmer than I normally would be. But it wasn't like I was a great meditator. I just led a very busy, active life, and it was ordinary unwinding that was happening. I was just giving myself a chance to unwind. And so it was nice to unwind. I got calmer. But I had this idea that I'm the one who's doing the effort, and this is what I'm supposed to do, and I had all ideas about effort and me being the one who's making effort. And when I came on retreat, that first day, lo and behold, the unwinding happened. I took credit for it. Me, the doer. The second day, the unwinding had unwound as much as it was going to do kind of naturally, and I was still there being the doer. I'm going to do this, I'm going to apply myself, I'm going to do this. But without the unwinding helping me, the effort I was making, the straining, the striving that I was doing, didn't work. In fact, it was counterproductive. And so I learned, I learned only by the third day, in the ruins, in the ashes of the ruins, that I was made the wrong effort. And actually, it took me a couple of retreats to realize that, to really understand what I was doing. I would crash and get to the bottom. And then only when I got to the bottom, somehow, then I wouldn't be making this self-conscious, self-centered effort. I wouldn't be striving as much. I'd just be more humble and relaxed about what I was doing. So sometimes on retreat, some of you probably may be the same thing, that by doing the same activity over and over again, you start noticing some of the intentions, some of the attitudes, some of the approaches that we are doing, and we start seeing the weak link. We start seeing where we're maybe a little bit off. This isn't quite right to what we're doing, that we wouldn't do if we just did it every once in a while. So if while you're doing this, you're discovering speed bumps along the way, or barriers along the way, or you find that something's not working, take heart. It's not wrong to discover how, that it's not quite working or it's not quite the right thing. It's designed to show you that, so that then you can make a course correction. Maybe relax, don't try so hard. Maybe make more effort. One of the issues I had in my Zen training was after a while, after a few years of doing that kind of practice, I started to get really easy to sit down to meditate. Easy in the sense that I would sit down and I'd be very calm and very still fairly quickly. And so I got lulled by that calm and pleasant feelings into complacency. And then I spent a couple of years being very complacent. And I thought things were fine, but whatever. And just kind of there. And I had some point, after a couple of years of that, it took a couple of years for me to see I was complacent. I was kind of coasting along, and I needed to kind of bring more effort in to my practice. So these swings happen sometimes large, it's over years. Sometimes they happen over brief periods of time, like a sitting. But still, there's these swings, and we learn our way. And to a great extent, meditation is something you learn by doing, not by reading a book. It's a self-learning project. So effort and energy is important. This and understanding something about what kind of effort is needed. The factor of awakening, which is the of energy, is a sub-class of just energy in general. And it's I think it's useful to kind of back up a little bit and take the wide bird's eye view of what we're doing when we come to a retreat or when we meditate. To realize that there are multiple kinds of effort that we're making, different things we're applying ourselves to, at different, sometimes simultaneously. And so, for example, I could say it takes a lot of effort to come to a retreat. Some people have to do a lot of planning and a lot of arranging, come long distances, and it can be a real hardship for some people to come on retreat. And so it makes a lot of effort, maybe it's a huge financial loss for some people compared to what, what their income is maybe to, you know, so it makes big effort, a choice to do here, and to make that effort to come takes a lot of effort. And then you come to retreat, and the teachers might, some teachers might say, don't make any effort, just relax. You know, what? Don't they realize how much effort I had to take to get here? And then it takes effort to get up in the morning. It takes effort to show up when the bell rings to come and sit in the meditation hall. It takes effort when you don't want to come. It takes effort to come and show up. And then it does take effort to sit upright, to sit this way. It takes effort to sit upright and not move. And then it takes effort to begin showing up in the present moment. And, you know, this hourglass analogy that I gave, perhaps, you know, if you're on the external side of it, kind of into the thinking about the past and the future, and the mind is kind of wild, a lot of effort's needed to rein it in, to be in the present moment. And literally, I think a very good analogy for what meditation is like sometimes, it's like the rodeo. And the very fact that you didn't fall off your zafu, you didn't leave your cushion for the period, is a sign of success. It worked. I didn't leave. You know, you might have had to break into a sweat even to be able to manage to stand there, because there's tremendous powerful forces inside of us that are very demanding, want us to act and do. Some of you, if you've struggled with addiction issues, know the tremendous force of addiction, that the compelling voices inside, the authority of these inner voices and desires are so strong that I have to move now, I have to have that now, I have to have whatever it is, something has to happen. And or the restlessness can be so strong. Or, you know, all kinds of very, very powerful forces inside that can happen sometimes. And to simply to stay present, to stay put in your seat, can sometimes take a lot of effort. And to appreciate that, don't feel like it's wrong to do that. Don't feel like you're a bad meditator. You should really celebrate the success of not having fallen off, the horse. Wow, I did it, 45 minutes. And even though it didn't look meditative, in terms of building character, in terms of becoming freer and not giving in to these powerful forces we have, it's a very learning, very maturing thing to do. But perhaps it isn't so powerful, the inner forces, but still, there might have to be, the effort might be, come back, come back, come back, come back. At some point, and there's no way of knowing when that point might be, the kind of effort we make changes from maybe something more effortful or willful to something that's more characterized by a willingness rather than being willing. So what I mean is, so you might have to keep making self-conscious effort, come back, show up over and over again. But at some point, the conditions are such that all you might need to do is to allow, is to let go, is not to do anything, but to not do. And it's a little bit similar to maybe catching a wave if you're surfing. If the wave is coming, and you have to do work. Sometimes you have to do a lot of work, a lot of effort to paddle and get fast enough. to kind of be in the right speed to have the wave catch you. But once you're up on the surfboard, or once you're in the wave body surfing, then you need to stop paddling. and then you allow the wave to carry you along. But if you can, so you have to allow the, so in meditation sometimes we have to make the effort sometimes a lot of effort to paddle, but then you have to know when to stop paddling. And then when you stop paddling and allow the, you create the conditions so you can allow yourself to surf, allow yourself to be carried along. And at some point in meditation, any effort at all messes with the surfboard. Any effort at all, and it kind of, you know, you don't want to make any effort anymore because the conditions are in place, the wave has been caught, and you just want to kind of ride it. And maybe you have to make small adjustments, on the surfboard, left, right, or something, to kind of stay on the wave, but you don't need to make any effort particularly anymore except those very small little adjustments. So all this is to say that one of the tasks of meditation is to start becoming sensitive, to be aware of this beautiful quality, important quality we have of applying ourselves, of making effort, of using our vitality, our energy, for the purposes, just in the right way. And no one can tell you that it's just one way. This is how it should be done. One shoe fits all. But in different circumstances, different situations, different things are called for. And so it's up to you to kind of understand what is wise, what's a useful way to do it. So the factor of energy or effort follows after investigation. And part of the function of investigation is to begin teasing apart what's happening right here, with the different elements of what's happening in the moment. And one interesting way of teasing apart the different elements of our experience is to differentiate three different aspects of the present moment. There is what's happening. There is what we're doing. And there is how we are. So what's happening, what we're doing, and how we are. So for example, if you're here in the meditation hall, what's happening is there's a group of people who are meditating. That's kind of the situation. You're in a group of people with a group of people meditating. And then what are you doing? You're trying to meditate. Or you are meditating. How are you? And that can be quite a wide range. You're delighted and inspired. You're discouraged and deflated. You know, and every, you know, all kinds of possibilities, right? But kind of how are you? The subjective experience of how we are in our being. And these are three things that can be happening in the present moment. And how do we relate to each of them is very important. The first, what's happening? Certainly you can kind of see around you what's happening. Kind of look around, your whatever's happening is happening. And we can start getting wise about, do I need to intervene? Do I need to do something? Or can I leave things alone? And if I'm going to intervene, how do I intervene? So if you're the lunch dishwasher and you're at breakfast and breakfast comes to an end, where you're at is the end of a meal, people doing their dishes, or someone has to go do the operate the dishwasher, and nothing to do with you. And you just let it be. But after lunch, it does have something to do with you. And so you make the effort. You might not want to do the dishes, but you go, that's your time to do it, and to support the community, you go and do it. So you have to kind of see, does a situation I'm in require something of me? And some people are fixers, like to fix everything. Some people like to be involved in everything. Some people have opinions about everything and are, you know, involved. And some people pull back and don't want to be involved in anything. So part of the self-understanding that we try to come to in mindfulness, what kind of person am I? How am I in this situation? Do I just leave it alone? I'm a lunch dishwasher, but I keep wanting to go and help the breakfast people because, you know, I can't help it. How is it for you? And maybe some people have to learn how to let go of wanting to fix it or help, and some people need to kind of, be more disciplined after lunch and go to the dishwashing area rather than go to the room and take a nap. That's what they really want to do. Because, so different things are needed at different times. So I made those examples of kind of an external world. But the same thing with our internal world. There's what's happening. There's what's happening in the moment, and there's some discernment needed about what we allow and leave alone, and what we are involved in and try to fix. And so we talked a little bit about pain. So it's absolutely, if you have any hint or idea that you might be injuring yourself, you should move, do something. But if it's an unpleasant sensation, very uncomfortable, but it's not, if you're pretty confident it's not going to be injurious, then you have an opportunity. And the opportunity is to not do anything about it and see what happens. Or not do anything about it and learn about the forces inside of you, the beliefs, the thoughts, the emotions that come into play around being uncomfortable. And it's a very rich laboratory to discover our attitudes about discomfort. Some people have very deep-seated beliefs about needing to avoid discomfort, what discomfort means. Any kind of discomfort means that it means failure, it means something is deeply wrong, something has to be fixed, someone's to blame. All kinds of things come into play. And then there can be impatience, there can be strong aversion, there could be fear, there can be self-pity. There's all kinds of emotions and attitudes that come into play. All of them might be prompting you or saying you, move, do something. And perhaps sometimes discomfort is not a discomfort that needs to be fixed. And it can be very powerful to see that difference and then sit still and not do anything. And learn how to let go or not give in to these forces that say move, move, move. Other times it's important to learn to move. I know I had this Zen training where in Zen you're pretty much not allowed to move during meditation. And not only are they not allowed to move, but they actually come around with this sword, stick, and hit you on the shoulder. It's not so bad. It's better than it sounds. This floor monitor comes around. And so the discipline, not moving, is strong. And there I had to learn at some point not to give so much authority to the external world, to this great world religion, Zen Buddhism, and the all-knowing Wizard of Oz, behind the curtain. And the Zen people, the Zen, they know, and I was a young kid then, young 20, 21, and like, I can't move, who am I to think I should move? And it's at some point, I realized this is crazy. I'm hurting myself. I'm going to damage myself. And so I had to make the effort to stand up against this, one of the great father figures of our mother figures. I don't know what you authority figures, Zen Buddhism. So maybe some of you have holding up Vipassana Buddhism as a great authority figure. You're going to have to someday, outgrow it. I hope so. To know what, you know, what is happening, to recognize what's happening, and to be able to know when something needs to be done and when something doesn't need to be done, and just allow it to be there. If it does, nothing needs to be done, just allow it to be there and learn to have your peace with it. There's a story of a monarch of a great country who wanted a painting painted that would depict peace, peaceful, just create a tremendous aura or representation of peace, peacefulness. And great artists from all over the country submitted their works for this competition. There was going to be a big reward. And all kinds of peaceful-looking paintings showed up. And the king said, no, no, no. And the ministers started getting kind of frustrated. I mean, nothing worked. I mean, they couldn't believe it. They'd gone to all the corners of the realm, almost everywhere they could think of, to find some artist who could paint, to try to find something to please the king, and nothing worked. And they thought they'd gone to every possible painter, artist, they heard about, as these stories go, a poor peasant, you know, high up in the distant mountains, you know, who rumors had was also a painter. So they went to this person and said, can you make a painting that depicts peace? So the person did. I said, I can do that, I think. And so they came back some months later, looked at the painting, and the minister was shocked, you know, that's not a peaceful painting. And it was a huge, a tumultuous waterfall, pouring water down and cascading down, and bouncing off the bottom, and steam, and lots of power, lots of energy, lots of chaos, and all that. And nothing to do with, the minister, nothing to do with peace. And so, but the king really wanted to see all the paintings. And so, they felt, well, we have to take it. So they took it to the palace, and they had it covered over. And when the monarch stood there, they took it off, and the cover, and the king looked at it kind of wide-eyed and said, what? This is not peaceful. But the peasant was there, and the peasant said, oh, but you have to get really close. Go up close to the painting. It's a big painting. Go close to it. And kind of really close to the painting. And right there, kind of near the middle of the painting, there was a little place where the water kind of parted. And if you look into that where it parted, through the place where it parted, there was a little ledge in the cliff. And on this ledge was a little nest. In the nest were some birds sitting there very peacefully. And so that peasant won the contest. And probably all the others had created this idyllic, peaceful scene, romantic and all that. But the peasant painted something, maybe it was more realistic about how life is. So how things are, sometimes things can be chaotic. Sometimes things are not how they should be. And there is a possibility of finding peace in the middle of the conditions of the world of how it is, regardless of how chaotic it is, and that the path of freedom, the path of spiritual growth in Buddhism, is finding that peace that can, where our heart's at peace, our life's at peace, how we are is at peace, even in the midst of tumultuous energy and chaos. So one of the things that trainings on retreat, for example, is how to learn to work with and find your peace with the conditions that you have here. And so sometimes things on retreat are not ideal. And we make our efforts to kind of create the most ideal circumstance we can for meditation, but sometimes things aren't what they should be. And that becomes your practice. Like they said in the cooks at Spirit Rock, they had a sign on the dining room that said, "Our practice is to make the best food we can. When we don't, that becomes your practice." So, you know, they were sincere in doing the best they could, but when they couldn't and they served, you know, food that was somehow whatever, then rather than complaining and writing a letter to the director and being upset, the practice is, how do you find your peace with this as well? How do you learn about yourself? How are you mindful? How do you work with this so that things are at ease? So that's a very important part of the training. How do we find our peace with what is? So there is. So the first thing about the present moment is what's happening. We try to understand what our responsibility is with what's happening, whether to do something or not. But here in the retreat, it's designed that very little needs to be done. So it's a wonderful opportunity to kind of back off and discover how to be peaceful with what is. And then the second aspect is what we are doing. How are we relating to what's happening? What are we doing with what's happening? Are we trying to fix everything? Are we trying to attain something? Are we trying to... there were times when I practiced where I had the sledgehammer approach to meditation. I was just going to pulverize my problems, you know, whatever arose in my... If I started thinking, bang, I had a very aggressive attitude towards my thoughts, you know, bang, you know, knock it down, cut it off. And it took me a while to realize that I was very aggressive and that it was necessary. In fact, it was counterproductive. So given what's happening in the present moment, what are you doing? What's your intention? What are you trying to accomplish? And that sometimes is not so obvious. We can have layers of intentionality. Sometimes we say, well, I'm washing the dishes. That's what I'm trying to do. But maybe what we're doing is we're trying to wash the dishes to get the job done as quickly as I can so that I can get to where the real practice is in meditation hall. Dishes is not real meditation. And so we have this attitude towards it, which limits our ability to get the most benefit from really being present just for the dishes. Or perhaps, you know, we're doing the dishes, but we're concerned about how the other people on the dishwashing crew are judging us as we do them. And we're trying to do it in such a way that we please them. So what's involved is pleasing people. You know, we're a perfectionist, and so we don't feel at ease until we've done every possible little iota of perfection in every job we do. And so we're in the dishwashing area, you know, 3 hours after lunch, still kind of polishing, you know, every possible thing. So how is it? What do you bring? What do you do when you do? And what's the sense of self? What are you doing in terms of your self? Understanding how you represent yourself, how you see yourself in the situation, how much self is involved in the activity you do. Do you have attitudes about yourself in the moment? It's possible to do dishes and have grand ideas that how you're going to be the best dishwasher IRC has ever seen, and people better know it. And it's possible to just do the dishes, you know, without that, you know, that could just gotta do the job and as it's called for, and then be done, and not have any thoughts about you as a dishwasher, good or bad or whatever. Just do it. So, what are we doing is a very important question. What are our intentions, our attitudes? What do we bring along with us in the situation? Because that's effort as well. The attitudes we have, the intentions we have, the things we're trying to accomplish that might be under the surface of the overt thing we're doing, that's also involves effort and energy. one of the nice things about something like meditation practice is that is that we do very little. Very little is needed, especially sitting in the hall, sitting with the eyes closed. We don't have to do very much. And we start, as we do less and less and relax, we start going through sometimes the layers in our mind of the doings that we do, the things we put making effort in. So the more, now we're talking more the psychological, the mental things we're doing. So as we're, so first we sit down to meditate and we don't do activity, the body's being still. And that takes a while to get used to, and because maybe there's a lot of restlessness that we want to do. And finally we just are here. But then we also want to speak to someone, and so we realize that strong addiction or desire to speak, relax. That also quiets down. And then we realize that what we want to do is we want to, it's a whole layer of things, but, when I crashed and burned in my early retreats, I wanted to get concentrated, and I was there to get concentrated. And so I had to see that was a lot of doing, a lot of agitation involved around getting concentrated. And then underneath there was this idea of needing to prove myself in the eyes of the teacher. I wanted the teacher to approve me, I wanted to please him, and so I had to I thought that getting concentrated was the way to do that. So once I let go of the desire to get concentrated, I saw how much approval and being liked was important for me. And then when the idea of wanting approval and being liked was relaxed and it went calmer, then I saw that underneath there that I felt pretty insecure. And so then and insecure took a variety of forms. One of the forms was guilt. One of the forms was feeling that it's an attitude that I'm wrong even before I do something. And it was amazing, my capacity to have this attitude that I was wrong, no matter. I mean, I was wrong and guilty. I remember how I walked across the meditation hall floor. Isn't that an amazing thing to feel guilty about? Because it was such a deep layer in my mind, I applied it to everything I was doing. And I had to get very, very quiet to see how some of these things are operating. But they're still doings. It takes energy and effort to do these things, even though they might be subconscious for a long time. So as we get get quieter and stiller and do less and less of the usual things we do, we start discovering more and more about these underlying operating principles that run our lives. Some of it is not necessarily good news. So it's been said by someone that self-knowledge is seldom good news. But that's mitigated if you can, laugh at yourself. If you're able to laugh at yourself, you'll never stop being amused. Because it's amazing what their minds can do. So what are we doing in the situation? What are we adding to it? What are we doing that's unnecessary? And here's a very interesting question, reference point, for this exploration. And that is to ask yourself, what is interfering with me being at ease right now? What's interfering with being at ease right now? And if you start looking around, I don't feel easeful right now. Why not? What's happening? And chances are very high that there is some doing that's going on. It might not be self-conscious doing. It might not be the usual place that you operate from. But still, these deeper layers, there might be some doing, some activity we're doing, some belief, some attitude, something. And maybe there's a lot of things that the mind does that doesn't need to be done. We're sitting here meditating. It's a pretty safe place. We don't have to prove ourselves. We don't have to defend ourselves. We don't have to... Very little needs to happen. And there can be an argument in the head that says, well, something does need to happen. It's a big deal to take a week out of my life. And this teacher says nothing has to happen, just sit there and, you know, it's all kinds of great things I could be doing instead. But what happens is we do less and less and less. We learn to undo more than to do more. We're pulling the rug from underneath all the things that get in the way of what's most beautiful in us, with the deepest layers of peace. And that now we're coming to the third thing, which is how we are. There's what we do, there's what's happening, what we're doing, and how we're reacting to it, how we're relating to it, for example. And then there is how we are. Before we talk about that, I want to give one story for the what we're doing. Two women joined the monastery at the same time. And as these stories go, one was aristocrat, wealthy, privileged, well-educated, capable, and used to getting what she wants. And the other was, you know, a poor peasant, humble. And the first one, the aristocrat, came to the abbess and said, I want to join the monastery, and asked the abbess, if I practice here in the monastery, how long until I get enlightened? And the abbess said, oh, probably about 10 years. 10 years? But I'm capable. What if I'm going to really try hard, push hard and all that? And how long will it take then if I really make a lot of effort? Oh, in that case, it'd probably take 20 years. So that's the end of that story. I got my two stories confused, so that's... Well, now, so I'll tell you the other story. This is meant for the last piece about how we are. They're quite related. They're not so separate, these things. But so again, there's these two people. I was going to make an example of men and women, so now I'll do the men. You know, they're a wealthy aristocrat, capable, educated, successful in all kinds of endeavors, and comes to the monastery and asks the abbess, you know. The abbess asks him, why do you want to come here? And he says, I'm here to attain the full glory and brilliance of the Dharma and enlightenment. And she says, be careful what you ask for. But he goes in and he's like determined. And so he goes, as soon as he can, he goes into the meditation hall and he sits down and he sits down, really gets concentrated, and has, in fact, is very capable, and get very concentrated, very still, very quickly, and it's just great. And he's very enthused, and I can do this. I can get enlightened. And so he pushes and tries, and sure enough, this brilliant glory and light of the Dharma starts appearing for him, and he throws himself into it more and more. And then he bursts into flame, and all is left after few seconds, just ash on his cushion. Careful what you ask for. And not a few people I've known, haven't gone burned up into ashes, but I've known people who have really pushed hard and gotten the kind of concentration, kind of hard, tight concentration by pushing hard in meditation, and it was not pretty, the results of it. And the peasant comes to the monastery, right? Of course, it has to be the peasant. I apologize if we should have. And so comes and is humble, and the abbess asks him, you know, why are you here? And he says, I'm here to discover, to see the Dharma in the food I eat, in the work that I do, and in the faces of the other monastics. To see the Dharma in each activity he does. So that person entered the monastery and in short order became enlightened. So how are we? Are we striving? Are we tight? Are we demanding? Or are we, you know, humble? Are we willing to open our eyes and see the beauty and the value and the profundity of each thing that we, each moment? An important moment for me, a little moment, in a Zen Sesshin at Green Gulch, was I was sitting next to a visiting Japanese monk. So we sat for 7 days together. And the custom at the Zen Center was at the beginning of the Sesshin, they would come in with teacups in the middle of the afternoon, and we would keep this teacup for 7 days at our seat, and then every day in the afternoon they'd come and serve tea and a cookie at 3 o'clock or so in the middle of the afternoon to kind of sustain us through the rest of the afternoon. So we'd drink our tea and our cookie, and we'd keep our cup. On the seventh day, it was the end of the retreat, they would come and collect the cups. And there's a lot of bowing in Zen. But it's all choreographed, when you're supposed to bow, when you don't bow. And the monk next to me, when it was his turn to give back his teacup, come completely on his own, outside of the choreograph, everything, he bowed to his cup. And I was so touched. Why would you bow to your cup? I mean, look, just a cup. But, you know, this reverence and care, this thing too. This thing here. And that's one of the hallmarks of Soto Zen, is this care and reverence for each thing that you encounter. Each thing, you know, has its, you know, you don't dismiss anything, you don't treat anything disrespectfully, nothing has less values. Everything is important. Every person, everything. So how are we? At the beginning of this retreat, Adrian talked about the seven factors of awakening as being like gems, jewels, or these treasures, the seven treasures of a monarch. And in Buddhism, they're considered wealth, form of wealth. Loving kindness is a form of wealth. Compassion is a form of wealth. The most precious thing that we have is how we are. And we are the caretakers of how we are. We are the caretakers of the qualities of our hearts and minds. And the quality of our hearts and minds is consequential. It's meaningful. We, you know, the inner life, if it's conflicted and afraid and anxious or angry, or caught up in the bondage of lust, you know, it doesn't feel good. But a heart which is at ease, peaceful, tranquil, at home in itself, a heart which sings in joy and happiness, a heart which is contented, feels the great, there's kind of a almost paradoxically, when I first discovered this, there's a tremendous satisfaction and pleasure in compassion, clean compassion. Many people confuse compassion with distress, or mix them up, or kind of, you know, get them entangled. But clean, pure compassion feels very nice. Love, loving kindness. There's such a wide range of beautiful factors in our own hearts and minds. And one of the most meaningful ones for me is the kind of the seat and the source that allows all the others to flow forth is a heart which is at home in itself. That's a heart that's at rest in itself. Because often we're not at rest, we're not at home, but we're you know, sometimes a centrifugal force to go outwards, to do, to get, or there's a force to kind of protect and, you know, and if you're in your home, but your home is a fortress, it's not very comfortable. But to be at home, to be at rest, and in that restful place, then there's space to flow some of the most beautiful qualities of a human being. And these are qualities that our world needs. Our world could really use a lot of more people who have compassion, who have love, who have generosity, who have wisdom, people who are at peace, people who can go into the waterfalls of our society and demonstrate peace or be peaceful, not be caught in it, be wise. And that capacity is conditioned or dependent on learning how to be at home in our own hearts, to be settled here, to be at peace, to be at ease, right here. Not the kind of ease that comes from needing to attain something or get something or to prove ourselves or, you know, be the first one to get some meditation attainment. But it's a little bit more like undoing. It's like undoing and not doing all the things that we do, they add. Not to suffer. Not to do the kind of things that the clinging, the grasping, the craving that is behind suffering. So we make an effort. Sometimes we make a lot of effort. Sometimes the effort is more to allow. Sometimes the effort is to not make any effort whatsoever. It's possible to make tremendous effort at staying relaxed. Isn't that nice? That the two can go together? Some people associate tremendous effort with straining and you know, being tense. But to really be diligent, to stay really present in a relaxed way here, and to learn how to be gentle, compassionate, and wise about what we discover in ourselves as we go through the layers of the mind and heart. None of you are wrong. Nothing that happens to you, nothing that comes out of your own heart and mind, do you need to see as being wrong if you're sitting quietly and meditating and not acting on it. It's only when you start acting on things that you have to be careful, because you could hurt people. But when you sit here and meditate, or when you do walking meditation, this is a time and place where you can have a kind of reverence to whatever is there. You can bow to whatever is there. If you're afraid, if you're angry, if you're desirous, clinging, if you're suffering, there's something very profound and very meaningful and very opening and freeing is to almost like bow to that or to hold that or to allow it. Just meet it with your presence. Just be there for it. Do less. Nothing more than to be present in a caring way and be present in a full way for what's there. It's very powerful. And then when it's the rodeo, put on your seatbelt. Hold on to your cushion, whatever it takes. You know, sometimes you have to make a lot of effort, and sometimes you have to break into a sweat, even. And all along, the guidance for what to do is, does it help you to become free? Does it help you not to suffer, free of suffering? Does it help you not to cling, not to close down? Does it help you to be present and open and relaxed here at this moment? At the risk of being saying too much today, I'd like to end with a poem, or not a poem, it's connected to a poem, but the prose part of a teaching by the Buddha. Someone came to the Buddha and said, how do you cross the flood? How do you cross the flood? And the flood is symbolic or represents the floods of suffering, the floods of craving and lust, the floods of wanting that are going to drive human life. And the Buddha said, by not stopping and not striving, I crossed the other side of the floods. If I stop, you'll drown. If you strive and push too hard, you'll get swept away by the currents. So neither stopping nor striving. It's just a steady stepping forward, just steadily going ahead, one step at a time, one breath at a time. Take the next breath, take the next breath, take the next step, this next one, just steadily in a relaxed way, without stopping because of discouragement or other things that seem more important. Just steadily hold the course. But don't push ahead too fast. Be respectful for each moment. Just this step. Don't be ahead of yourself. Neither stopping nor straining. So part of this wonderful factor of effort is persistence. Just keep doing it. Keep going. So let's take a moment and a minute to sit quietly and recollect.